time, making an obvious point. This is a point made by Kathy Weeks in her book, The Problem with Work, is the fact that wage labour is central to the capitalist mode of production. As she puts it, it's the way in which most people acquire access to the necessities of food, etc. Also, she focuses on the socialising aspects of wage labour. It's the most important source of sociality, raising children with attributes that will secure them forms of employment is the gold standard of parenting. So she's linking up, she's referring here, I suppose, to Habermas as well. If we focus on that formulation or that concept, I think we can identify two immediate problems, or two things that come out of this. One is that the relation between capital and labour doesn't just involve exploitation. We've seen the gap between the value that workers are paid for their labour power and the value that they produce during production, what was discussed in week one as surplus value. Surplus value is a discussion of the rate of exploitation in some sense. And Marx tends to use the word exploitation fairly technically in that sense, not with the full aspects that we have of, of sort of drawing blood out of people, etc. Exploitation is for him a rather more neutral concept. As for instance, when in the 19th century one would speak of the exploitation of the soil, for instance, that sense. But so this first aspect is that exploitation is involved, the surplus value, and then the historic struggles over the rate of exploitation, over surplus value. But the second fact coming from this is that, as Marx explains at least, the relationship between capital and labour is also one of domination. And that's a separate notion. Exploitation then is the rate of surplus. Domination is a social relationship of power and empowerment. Exploitation doesn't necessarily have anything directly to do there with power in that sense. And I think this power question, the question of domination, was the point of Marx's dramatization of the scene of production. In the handout, the extract that I gave you last week from Capital. What he says in that extract is that if we stop looking at the formal contract between the employer and the employee, on the face of it, that contract seems to be fair. You give me your labor power, I'll give you a wage. It seems to be fair, and it seems to be freely arrived at. And both of those aspects Marx emphasizes as being realities. The fact is that that in capitalism, wage labor is free in a way in which, for instance, providing work for the feudal lord in the feudal system was not free. There is an important gain to be registered here. But Marx says, don't look at that. Look at the social relations of production more narrowly. And he says, this is where this formulation comes in. He who before was the money owner now strides in front as capitalist. So money owner is just money owner versus possessor of labor power. Money owner, possessor of labor power, that's at the level of the formal contract, and that's free and fair, it seems. But this relationship between capitalist and laborer involves a relationship of domination, the one with an air of importance, smirking, intent on business, the other hesitant, like one who is bringing his own hide to market and has nothing to expect but a hiding. Is the formulation. So these two points need to be made of exploitation and of domination. So that's the first point to be made with regard to that the statement from Kathy Weeks is to draw at that point. The second point, I think, takes us closer to today's readings, which is that our society, as many critics or commentators have pointed out, has become a work society. And I think distinguish between between a market economy and a market society. That's the distinction we've made. And we no longer live just in a market economy, but in a market society. An implication of this is that the problem with work can't be reduced to the extraction of surplus value or the degradation of skill. It extends to the way that work dominates our lives. The struggle against work, which we saw in Thompson beginning to develop in the 17th and 18th century, a matter of securing not only better work, but also the time and money necessary to have a life outside of work. So think of the two aspects here. The one are struggles, the struggle for better conditions of work on the one hand. And those struggles obviously are always ongoing. Because the relationship between capital and labour is essentially an antagonistic one. So labour obviously wants to claim for itself things capital wants to claim. That relationship is a struggle for better conditions or for greater productivity, let's say, depending on your standpoint. But think also of the shift from market economy to market society, where the suggestion is that it's life outside of work. What happens to life outside of work under conditions of commodity production? When the commodity form becomes generalized, when we tend to think in terms of these categories, and we've already traced that through, if you like, at one level through Lukács and onto Adorno, if you like. So we're talking both about what work is. Historical struggles for better work, better remunerated, more rewarding, less alienating. I mean, that term that's often used in Marx and in the 20th century literature, the idea of alienation. And you can hear the philosophical tradition out of which this is coming, the sense in which what gets alienated, in other words, made strange or taken away from us, is an aspect of ourselves. But alienating, as it enters into the vocabulary, what does it mean exactly for you when you speak of something as being alienating? It's something that seems, I mean, boredom comes up, the classic modernist notions of ennui, of boredom, of tedium, etc., and so on. So less work in the context do we work to live? For instance, do we live to work? So what about what isn't work, what's outside of work? And that was part of the context for Adorno's discussion of free time, wasn't it, which we looked at last week. Go back to this formulation from Adorno, and let's just think through a couple of its implications here. His own tastes, his own predilections, his own what he does is very specific, and perhaps to us it rings as being Mandarin, and I think as being very elite, and so on. But think of what he's saying more generally. He goes on. He speaks of his own interests here. So what making music, listening to music, reading, writing. What he does. With his time, he's a philosopher, he teaches, he writes, he reads. He's able, of course, to dispose, in a certain sense, Adorno is able to create his own work. And what he is saying is that that if free time really was to become just that state of affairs in which everyone could enjoy what once was the prerogative of a few, you hear this language in Adorno always of his awareness of the fact that it's limited to the few, that it's restricted. His desire, what democratization should involve for him is the universalization of those freedoms, not the leveling down of other things. So that he says, then I picture it after my own experience of life.
outside work, although given different conditions, this model would in its turn necessarily alter. He's not suggesting, obviously, that everybody should become a specialist in Beethoven. That's not what it took, because he is, as it were. It's not that everyone should do what I do. It's that everyone should have the resources and the opportunities and the ability to define the content of their own freedom. I think that's what he's suggesting here. If that's what free time should mean, if free time in some way should be connected to an idea of human freedom, that's what it would involve for Adorno. And that category comes up so that you can see the opposition there within the long humanist tradition, if you like, of freedom on the one hand and alienation on the other, where alienation is always the taking away of parts of ourselves in some sense. So that this, the fact that this becomes a problem in a work society is what we're describing today. So that freedom is in these terms, it's a practice, it's not a possession. You don't have freedom, you make it. In some sense, freedom is about action of a certain kind. It's a process, not a goal. And in fact, as we would see from Foucault, for instance, perhaps Foucault would say that in some ways, the fact is, it's always a process. It isn't. Freedom should never be conceptualized as a hurdle which you can climb over or jump over once and for all, because that would. It's not a destination. You don't get to freedom. Freedom is a constant act of making it, of as a process. So if we're talking about the work society, one problem we can say is productivism. That's the term that is sometimes used. Also think of the idea of the work ethic. In some way. And we're not talking here about it only in the realm of work. The whole problem with productivism or with the work ethic is we're talking about it in a work society when it seems to govern all aspects of our life, not just at work. So the degree to which life gets looked at in the prism of, I'm tempted to call it a labor theory of value, although it's not Marx that we're talking about here. It's the idea that value, that the only source of value for us is connected in some way with labor, under certain very specific conditions. What about other kinds, though, of work or value considered differently? Think of all those debates playing themselves out now about what is the value of a humanities education, for instance. If the only measure of a university education is how much money you can go on to earn, then you can see why humanities might be in the crosshairs of this. I mean, obviously, for those of us in the humanities who have an investment in it, we want to say, well, much more is involved than how much money you go on to earn. Now, that isn't the only way to think about what is valuable about this. But in a productivist ethic, it's difficult to get to those kinds of, it's difficult to find the space to argue for other kinds of value. So productivism then isn't only a description of how work is organized, it's also a description of the way in which life is organized, in which life outside work, this is a very Adornian line, begins to take on the attributes of productivized work. So we often think in terms of the binaries work and free time, production and consumption, for instance. But think of this statement from Terry Lovell in her very important book from the 1980s, I think, called Consuming Fiction, where the standard way of thinking up until then had been to look only at production, without thinking of production and consumption in some ways as going together. And here's Lovell arguing in Consuming Fiction that there are these contradictory requirements. The sale and purchase of commodities implies the controlled release of pleasures and their channeling through commodity consumption. Marx, she says, was aware of this double standard. Each capitalist demands that his workers should save, but only his own because they stand towards him as workers, but by no means the remaining world of workers, for these stand towards him as consumers, Marx says, and so on. So perhaps we've taken too seriously the pious speeches emanating from these institutions, for capitalism is simultaneously transmitting another message, spend, spend, spend. And we saw that, I think, in the debates about Puritanism in the Working Day chapter, but also in Thompson, that if, on the one hand, capitalists are arguing for that people should be more sober, they should work harder, they should have better work habits, etc., etc., capitalism is also arguing that people should be spending. That sense of the doubleness of the two, that you can't separate those two demands. And let me take you towards Jean Baudrillard's work here to a certain degree, because Baudrillard, who we're not looking at this year, but if you're interested, does follow on from the Lukács Adorno line very strongly. And Baudrillard here, this is towards a theory of consumption. And what is striking about his analysis is that he puts production and consumption together as part of one and the same process of expanded reproduction of the productive forces. So the themes of spending, enjoyment, and non-calculation have taken over from the Puritan themes. But in fact, this is an internal substitution, he says. A new system of values for an old one. What could become a new finality has become, when emptied of its real content, an enforced mediation of the reproduction of the system. So what Baudrillard is doing here is to refuse the opposition, if you like, between work and free time. Perhaps the idea of free time in the sense of freedom as something which would be self-regulated, self-governed, lies just on the kind of unspoken horizons of what Baudrillard is saying. But what he's also saying is that what is called freedom or free time cannot be understood in those terms. And he's very radical in that thinking. So he says consumption is a function of production and not a function of enjoyment. I mean, what's one of the more hair-raising aspects of Baudrillard's work is that he defines enjoyment as a function of the system. I mean, in a sense, arguing that just as with Adorno, fun is compulsory, so for Baudrillard, enjoyment it enters into a generalized system of exchange, which he defines as hysterical, in some sense, what he calls consumativity, which is a social demand. You have to consume. And then he goes on to make the point that I'm suggesting here at the bottom. This is the equivalent and extension in the 20th century of the great 19th century long process of the training of rural populations for industrial work. So we have, if you like, E.P. Thompson on the one hand describing a process that unfolds from, let's say, the mid-18th century onwards until the end of the 19th. And then here's Baudrillard suggesting that on the side of consumption, there is another century-long process of enforced education in some sense. But that idea that enjoyment is a social prerogative, it's a systemic logic. He defines, in fact, enjoyment as something which is never individual or anything like that. Enjoyment is not something that you decide for yourself. It's not something that you read. You know that in the old language of use value, for instance, that enjoyment would, in some sense, be a function of the use of commodities. You buy them because you need them and you use them. And enjoyment would seem in that sense, to derive from, you know, enjoyment is something that comes from our use of commodities. And Baudrillard blocks that particular kind of thinking because he suggests that, in fact, that enjoyment is merely the name given to a certain social logic of consumption. That's not very well explained, I think, but it's. I just wanted to kind of shortly through this. You can read the Baudrillard by yourself if you're interested. I think this takes us directly into the nature of the intervention that Frieda Haug is making in her essay. So not all labour, she says, takes the form of wage labour. That's her first point. And what she's attempting to do, obviously, is to define forms of labour which not only are not productivist, but are anti-productivist in some way. Because Baudrillard works with this idea of a total system in some way, Baudrillard's a very kind of dark thinker in some sense. Frieda Haug is the diametrical opposite, very much a kind of a voluntaristic, opportunistic thinker in some way. She's an optimistic thinker also, as you can see by her negotiation here of this invisible, bar which is standing up by itself, a rather nice image, I think. But the so not all labour takes the form of wage labour. So let us think through these categories as we've got them. How do we think of work? Is work to be understood as world creating in some ways? Which I've used this term before of just because I want to distinguish between objectification, which is a kind of alienation, and another concept in which what we make is in some sense a registration of ourselves. It's the humanization of the world. And work, one way of thinking about work is of that. Our relationship to the natural, the outside world is one of humanization. It's a strong line of philosophical thought. Not necessarily that we have to affirm, but it creates a different notion of what subject-object relationship is. So do we understand as world-creating or as alienated? What's the relationship then between work and human activity generally? If we think of how Adorno understands what work ought to be, and for that matter of what free time ought to be, both ought to be in some senses. I mean, free time obviously should enable us to do things outside of the fairly narrowly prescribed, you could say, instrumental dimensions of work time. You work, for instance, as a physicist. You're working around a set of problems. You're producing something particular, whether that's theories or objects in some way. So that it's bound by that structure, but it ought in some way to engage you directly, personally. It ought not to be the sterile application of labour power. You know, oh God, I have to go in there and sit at a calculator, as it were, and just tote up figures. That would be not what's involved. But on the other side, of course, there are all sorts of activities that are not part of that narrowly bound notion. So on both sides, there's room for things to be added. If you look at the long kind of history of the way in which work has been represented, one finds both aspects. One finds work being described as profoundly dehumanizing, for instance, to use again the humanist language, of alienating, of boring, arduous, unrewarded. I mean, there's a great deal of sociological and cultural expression of work. You know, work as not only as drudgery, but as something almost approaching kind of slavery. Think of that, of how important the term wage slave was in the 19th century. As an example of this, the example will be, I want to just play Paul Robeson's singing of the Volga boatman with images by Ilya Repin, and perhaps there are things to be said about this first. Does everyone know who Robeson? Robeson, probably the best known of the three. No? Does anyone know? Has anyone heard of Paul Robeson? Really? No. So okay, I'm just saying how old I am. So Robeson was the most famous African American singer, probably of the 20th century, a tremendously powerful baritone voice, made huge impacts. Was a leftist. Came into obvious confrontation with American politics in the 1920s already. Traveled very widely. Sang the full repertoire of opera, but also spirituals, early blues music. The voice is unmistakable. He, the summertime and the living is easy, that some of you may have heard. He was the sort of fundamental singer of this. So the Song of the Volga Boatman is interesting because it's a song from the Russian 19th century. Just at the time in which two things were happening in Russia. One was the development of a national cultural archive. The idea that there was, in fact, was there a repertory of Russian songs, of Russian stories, etc. And the sense of these as Russian works, particularly. And the Volga Boatman, at the same time, also an awareness of the arduousness of work. And Ilya Repin was the great Russian painter of the last third of the 19th century, who put images of Russian workers out there, oil paintings, tremendously influential figure. The Song of the Volga Boatman was a shanty sung in Russian, obviously translated into English. It became tremendously popular. Cecil B. DeMille made a film called The Song of the Volga Boatman. It was also made into film versions in China, in Russia, as well as in the US. So this, it was, of course, in the US version, what happens is that a kind of a worker rises up against his terrible conditions. In China, it's slightly differently inflected. The Japanese are invading, and the Chinese, as a group, rise up. So some individual centered. But anyway, this is Robeson's version. But I'm describing this as a way of, here's how, if you like, this is the language of labor. At least it's one register of the language of labor in the late 19th, early 20th centuries.
What humans are capable of, and this, the blues and of I suppose blues particularly here, is in fact a vocabulary drug. That's the way in which culturally that form of work is represented, isn't it? I mean, there's no obvious reason why those kinds of that kind of music should signify that, but that's what it comes to because of its forms of encoding in the early 20th century. And Repin paints these images. Contrast that, let's stay within Russia for the moment, and contrast that with a representation from Maxim Gorky's book of 1923 called My Universities, which has nothing to do with university. I mean, the whole point about the book is that Gorky, the young narrator, doesn't go to university. He's deprived of the access of going to university. He's a would-be writer. He's a young kind of intellectual type, but his circumstances make it impossible for him to be educated to this level. And he describes in My Universities as this one scene, again set on the Volga, in Kazin, and it's a description of how the boatmen, who are idling around, drinking, fighting with each other, and so on. And suddenly, a consignment, I think a ship runs aground, and they have to get stuff off the ship very quickly. It's salt, it's perishable materials. They have to get it off the boat as quickly as possible. And the young writer describes, he in fact is drawn in, basically all hands on deck, and he happens to be around. And he begins to describe the work done these fighting, boisterous, cantankerous, difficult men who you would say have no redeeming qualities socially, at least that's how he sees it in the beginning. And then he begins to describe the way in which they work. And it's extraordinary how something magical seems to happen. And here we have a very different picture, I think, of what work is. So this is from, it's a long passage, so let me just allow you to read that. For a moment, it's a description from My Universities, particularly where it starts, and those ponderous, lazy men. So notice, they worked as though they had been starved of it, and as though they'd been waiting a long time for the sheer pleasure of throwing sacks weighing 160 pounds or more to each other and tearing around with bales on their backs. What we find is that the meaning of work has changed there. Whereas in the Repin picture, it's the work, it's the lack of money that you get for your work that starves you. Here it's, in some sense, the lack of work that starves you, rather than the too much work, as it were. But then the sense in which the mad dance, he describes this sense of the heroic poetry of everyday life, the whole heroic poetry of everyday work, in a sense. Something quite different is being described here. It's the world-making, or in fact world-breaking also, capacity of labor, collectivized labor here for Gorky. But it's that sense that's being registered. This is a very, very different picture of work than we got in the Repin, I think. And notice also the fact that for the young intellectual, it's a backward-looking, it's a retrospective story. It's a memoir that he's writing in some ways. What happens to his language when he comes? He's trying to describe a kind of a magical state that comes over the workers. You know, that there they are sitting around drunk and so on, and then suddenly they get up and it's almost as they go into a kind of a dance. There's something, and then how does the language describe that? It's interesting that Gorky's language also seems. It's as though his pen gets infected with a kind of entrancing aspect. The language has to dance to describe this kind of dancing as well. So I spent that night in an ecstasy that I've never experienced, but my soul was brightened by the desire to spend my whole life in that half insane rapture of work, etc. So we find here two very, very different notions, I think,
of work. I mean, we could say that we disbelieve both of them as well. I mean, that, you know, various possibilities are around. But if you think of work in this world making sense, you open yourself up to what Frigga Hauge is talking about when she introduces these four spheres of human activity. So there's employment, there's wage labour, she suggests. There's reproduction, which is to say, I think our relationship to our, not only to our families and to ourselves, but more widely to our communities and perhaps to our nations more broadly, that whole sense of social reproduction. There is personal development, by which you mean something like lifelong learning is the term that we use now. But it wouldn't only, I think, be educational. It could also obviously be a forms of exercise, various kinds of ways in which you think of personal development. Think of the Habermasian term of cultivation of the self, which is also something that Foucault has in mind. Where this isn't a vanity project, as it were. It's not just about making yourself prettier or more glamorous. It has to do with, in some ways, defining yourself in the world. And finally, there's this realm of politics, by which she means everything from neighborhood watches upwards to, you know, to the grand politics of the state. And so she suggests that there are, you know, those four realms. And I guess with Frigga Hauge, we're invited to add, to take away from those four, perhaps, but to add fifth and sixth if we want to, if we can think of fundamental aspects of social enhancement in some way that we might develop there. But I think that what she suggests is that those four could be weighed equally. Which is why she comes up with this. Obviously, it sounds as though it's unworkable. This idea of four chunks of 4 hours each. But as she points out, that this is not. She's not saying that you do 4 hours and then you shift. And some people might want to do much more on the one than the other. And this would presumably have to be worked out in some way. But when she comes to talk of the first of them, which is say wage labour, she says that by definition. It would involve a necessary shortening of every person's labour time to one-fourth of one's working time, that is to 4 hours. So she's talking about 4 hours of work at full pay. And she tying in here with an argument that we see very clearly, I think, in David Graeber also, but in many theorists from Keynes onward in the 1930s, which is that particularly if we're thinking of the social use of technologies, there is no reason whatsoever that work, that all of socially necessary work could be done by all of us in much less time, which would then leave much more time to do other things. But for how crucially that would have to, we would value those 4 hours at full rate. In other words, that you would be paid your full salary for working a half, or effectively a half day. I'm always interested in the sense that just today I was listening to the fact that employment figures, unemployment figures are at their lowest for quite a long time at the moment, and what this signifies. So that both left and right, as Graeber points out, seem to want there to be full employment, but without asking the secondary question of what kind of employment is this? How is it remunerated? The fact is that you know, with casualized work, for instance, and with a minimum wage that is barely kind of enough to live on, is full employment, and ought full employment to be the only metric that we have of this? So what happens when we talk about full employment? Ought that to be our goal, or oughtn't we be talking about, you know, happier employment or something like this? So she says it's no longer necessary to carry out labour limited to repetitive movement. This leads towards a concept of labour which joins the greatest possible diversification with the development of all human faculties. Bear in mind that this manifesto, which is obviously, it is a manifesto, it's incredibly general, it's incredibly vague at some levels. It was submitted to Parliament in Germany about 15 years ago, by the Green Party. So it was there, it was one of their kind of official platforms. So she is thinking that this is not just a theoretical exercise. You could say with Graeber's that some of the most obviously criticizable features of Graeber's are its sheer kind of utopianism in some way, in the bad sense. That sense of it being utterly unrealistic or unidealistic. So shift, if you will, to Melissa Gregg and her argument about that sense in which the new media technologies were meant or marketed as giving us the freedom to work wherever we want. I take it that in Gregg, the most important concept that she introduces is this idea of presence bleed. It's that sense in which we, by introducing flexibility or apparent flexibility, what has actually happened is that we're constantly on call, on duty. I was struck by the fact that we had a row in the English department last year about whether we ought to be permitted to email each other on work-related matters after, I can't remember exactly, 7 o'clock at night or over the weekends. And some people suggested that we ought, as a matter of principle, to kind of keep our work to within work hours, as it were. And other people said, I do, because I'm always teaching or doing admin, that's when I do my work, they would say, 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning or something like this. And they were quite, and of course you could solve it by simply, by parking your messages and so they all get sent at Monday at 8 o'clock. But I was struck by the fact how passionately some people in the department argued for the right to be working at 3 o'clock on a Monday morning or something like this, as though that is an example, I take it, of presence bleed. So is the flexibility, if one's seeing this in terms of one's work is infinitely rewarding, as it were, then one could hardly object. If one wants to work because it's so exciting to be working, then who would say, no, you may not do it? But the same colleagues who are working all these hours are also the ones saying that the work is unrelenting. And so there obviously seems to be some problem here. Little has been written to illustrate the consequence of this development, where work is broken out of the office, downstairs to the cafe, into the street, to the train, later to the living room, dining room, and bedroom. And much of Gregg's work took the form of interviewing, particularly of women workers, women clerical, white-collar workers, who were talking very often of the fact that since the new forms of flexibility, what they found themselves doing was getting up at 4:30 in the morning, precisely in other words, so that they could have 2 hours or 3 hours, or whatever it would be, to do their emails, to work, before their children got up, before they had to do the housework or the social reproduction before they went to work. So that sense of what was happening was that it extended their working day, but understood as this, precisely because flexibility and the ability to govern your own time is such a high premium for them. They would say, it's so enabling that I can do this from home. But they understood fully well that they were always tired, as it were. Gregg is partly reflecting on this. So she introduces this category of presence bleed, firm boundaries between personal and professional identities no longer apply. And presence bleed explains the familiar experience of the location of time. Location and time of work become secondary considerations faced with a to-do list. And many of us experience this as a kind of subtle demand, for instance, if a superior writes to you on a Friday evening, say at 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, how free are you to say, it's a weekend? I'm not going to respond to it until Monday. But many of us also feel that as kind of, you know, you presence means being on. When are you not, as it were, on duty? That captures the feeling of anxiety that arises in jobs that involve a never-ending schedule of tasks that must be fulfilled, especially where there are not enough workers to carry the load. Greg is introducing this, and Greg then starts to push again towards the kinds of inquiry that we find in the Lukács to Adorno tradition, where she speaks of the quantification, the instrumentalization of intimacy. That if, in other words, that you're budgeting 2 hours from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, a child who is ill, for instance, becomes something that you just can't afford, or that is an extra kind of hardship, so that you begin to budget also the time that you spend with your children. The time, because work time is the dominant form of time understanding, then children time gets defined in terms of work time, 2 hours for them. It may be that what you do within those 2 hours is quite unlike a kind of work, but the very fact that it's kind of ended and started is the problem. Here's the an interview with Gray, now, which let's just look at a bit of. You'll see him making very similar arguments to what he does argue.
Bullshit jobs I define as a job where even the person doing the job secretly believes the job really shouldn't exist. But nonetheless, part of the conditions of employment is that the applicant candidate does. It's important to distinguish between bullshit jobs and shit jobs. Mostly when you say bullshit jobs, people first assume you mean jobs that just you don't really want to have. Jobs where they don't treat you well, jobs where they don't pay you well, jobs where you work under difficult or humiliating or adverse conditions. And most of the jobs that are shit jobs actually aren't bullshit jobs. Most of the jobs that oppress you are jobs like cleaners or dish diggers or nurses, servants of various kinds who are mistreated. At least now they're doing something. Bullshit job is actually kind of the opposite of that. A bullshit job, you're often given a lot of money, you're treated very well, a great deal of respect, and often seen as the person in your family who most needs something of yourself. But at the same time, you're secretly haunted by the knowledge that you're not actually doing anything, that if your job didn't exist at all, the world either would change in no way, or even might become a slightly better place. This is one of the great mysteries of our times, as far as I'm concerned, because we usually associate make work, stupid made up jobs, with state socialism. In the Soviet Union, they used to say, well, they make up jobs which are completely unnecessary. That makes sense because they had an ideology of full employment. On the other hand, capitalism, that's exactly the thing that isn't supposed to happen. A private firm would never hire someone and put out good money to someone who they don't actually need. But in fact, if you talk to people who work for large corporations, they do it all the time. How does that happen? I think part of it has to be explained by political pressure. In a way, just as in the Soviet Union, there was a central directive saying we need full employment. They didn't say, therefore, make up bullshit jobs, right? But they didn't say, don't do it. In a similar way, we have pressure from both the left and the right to create jobs all the time. On the one hand, you have the left saying we need public works, we need more money being given to consumers to stimulate the economy. On the right, they're saying, give money to capitalism, I'll hire people. But the one thing left and right totally agree on is the solution to all problems is more jobs. But they never say jobs that actually do something. Jobs that are worth the while anyway. It's just assumed that if jobs...
I think that the things to be said about the great note is firstly just the, as it were, the joy of his title. And the secretary is sitting there kind of giving this woman a job. Bullshit jobs are not to be understood as shit jobs, he says. And if we think of just, there's a sense in which a lot of it is a kind of infantile, not in the bad sense, but that peculiar sense of actually, of as it were, throwing the logic back in the face of those that you take to be the dominant. But notice also in Gray, something to think of, if we are going to take up this idea of bullshit, on the tube, when a course, changed to pointless jobs. And bits of the Graebner, without his knowledge, actually, were taken from his book and posted on the, all over the tubes for about a week, saying that, you know, we talk about the dignity of labour, but how can we do that when a very large proportion of people feel that their job has no dignity and shouldn't exist? Including people who are doing those jobs for you know, you do them often because they're of the respect and because there's a lot of money involved, but you secretly, as he says, feel that they shouldn't exist. And the question of the subjective in Graebner is obviously decisive. He defines bullshit jobs not through any kind of objective sort of measurement, although he comes up with these figures of jobs that contribute to social well-being and but his category is of how people feel about their own work, based on the interviews that he's done, which are not particularly extensive. I mean, this is not a scientific survey in any way. It's a provocation. It's a polemic, and we need to treat it that way, I think, in kind of considering it. Does it have anything for us to think about? So let's leave it there and take up the three. And then, you know, the three different, very different readings: one, an academic study; two, manifestos, if you like; the Howes, a political one; the Graebner, more, as I see it, a kind of a provocation, like a thought exercise. So let's, I don't mind which ones we talk about in seminars, see how we go.